is Jacksonville's public hospital dealing with coronavirus patients? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we speak with the CEO of UF Health Jacksonville about the pandemic, Duval County, and how local health officials are preparing for the Republican National Convention. Get on the line. It's 549-2937. Then later, a campaign to save the sea turtles at our beaches this nesting season. But first this hour, the latest on the coronavirus crisis by the numbers. The state now has nearly 160,000 cases and 3,500 deaths. In our area, there are three more deaths from COVID-19. 119 people in Northeast Florida have died from complications related to the virus. And as these cases keep mounting in Florida, hospitals are working to manage it, their COVID wards in particular. This as fewer ICU beds are now available in our area. Healthcare officials are also putting a plan together in place for the Republican National Convention later this summer. There will be an online briefing later this morning about all of this. We have a preview right now as we welcome Dr. Leon Haley. He's CEO of UF Health Jacksonville, and he's on the line. Dr. Haley, good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Ross. How are you today?
It's great to have you on the show. What are your questions for the CEO of UF Health Jacksonville, the former Shands, of course, this region's largest public hospital, as we talk about the COVID crisis? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJacks. Already getting your tweets and questions for Leon Haley, and our Facebook page is open. Dr. Haley, let me begin by asking you about the new mask mandate Mayor Lenny Curry ordered for the city of Jacksonville. How important do you think that move will be in slowing the spread of the virus here?
You know, I think it's absolutely critical. If you sort of go back to the sort of history of this virus and how it's impacted across the globe and the country and locally, we know many things, right? We don't have a great definitive treatment at this point. We have some things that we think are very helpful for admitted patients. There's no vaccine at this stage of the equation. But the one thing we do know that works incredibly well is a mask, right? We know that if you wear the mask, it helps prevent you spreading it. If you have it, if somebody else has the mask on, does the same thing. If you both have a mask on, it's a great thing, right? It really reduces the risk. And keeping, obviously, separation. So we've gone back. We've looked at the epidemiology of the disease. The mask is really important, as well as social distancing.
And since the mandate went into effect, already you see in grocery stores and places more people masking up, which is encouraging. 18 of the 19 Jacksonville City Council members supported this move by the mayor, except one, Council Member Danny Becton. He said he didn't think it would work and that it was government overreach. What would you say to the mask skeptics out there who are ignoring the overwhelming evidence on the side of public health around this?
Well, I think it's obviously disappointing, and we certainly would like to continue to encourage masking, right? We know it's the one, it's not a treatment, obviously, but it's very successful. There's been great evidence. If you look to some of the countries around the globe, New Zealand, Japan, a couple of others that have really been successful, it's worked because masking is universal, and it's been universal for a long time. So it is the one thing that works incredibly well.
549-2937 as we speak with Leon Haley, CEO of UF Health Jacksonville. Tell us what the situation is like inside your hospital, Dr. Haley. We're hearing that there are fewer ICU beds available across this city as we're seeing the uptick in coronavirus cases. How are you managing that at UF Health?
Well, we're busy, no question. I think, you know, the way we approach this is kind of through four different phases. We call them respond, restore, redesign, and revitalize. So in the early phase, it was really getting ready for COVID and, you know, not knowing exactly how many patients we would see. I mean, obviously, we were looking at New York and thought that there were going to be really significant volumes. And remember, at that time, we really talked about masks and distancing, and we had some great success. And then we phased into the restore phase, where we were able to start doing our elective surgeries, opening the hospital back up. And now we're still in that phase because we're still doing elective procedures, elective surgeries. We are busy. You know, we've got almost 40 COVID patients in the building right now, and that's our highest number, quite frankly.
That's the highest you've had since this began?
That's the highest we've had since it began. And I think there's a high basically across the city. So it does show you how there's a really a correlation between, you know, if you're not wearing your mask and you're not distancing, then, you know, the people get into gatherings and then the disease can spread. So right now we're full. We still have plenty of ICU capacity. We still have plenty of ICU beds, but we look at it daily. Actually, my team is on a call right now. We talk through it as a leadership and the management team every day, trying to manage, you know, obviously the COVID patients, but obviously the rest of the hospital. Remember, for us, we're still a trauma center, so we're still getting patients, you know, from car accidents and assaults. And so, you know, it's a balance that that the hospitals are doing across the city.
Sure. So you anticipate status quo for now. It sounds like a hospital in Miami, Jackson Memorial, they've stopped elective surgeries once again because they're concerned about becoming overwhelmed with patients. Do you anticipate anything like that here?
But we don't know. That's why we have a conversation every day. So we literally watch our numbers. We have a dashboard that we use where we can look at the number of cases in the city. We look at the number of cases in the hospital. We look at our ICU and ventilator capacity. We look at the number of tests. We look at our equipment. And then we talk through just sort of the ongoing volume. So like I said, our leadership team, by the way, that team has been meeting 122 days straight.
Mm-hmm.
We opened up our command center before COVID really started impacting this region, and so just in anticipation, and so we look at it every day. So right now, we're able to manage both the COVID patients, our regular volume, elective surgeries, but it is something that we watch on a daily basis. I hope we don't have to get to that decision. I can certainly understand. I know that CEO very well. I hope we don't have to get to that decision, but for the moment, we're managing.
We're speaking with Dr. Leon Haley, CEO of UF Health Jacksonville. What are your questions for him about the COVID pandemic? We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Let's talk about testing, Dr. Haley. The Curry administration says new testing sites are going to go up all around town in a couple of weeks. Every morning outside Lot J here in downtown Jacksonville, there's a long line of cars of people sometimes waiting hours to be tested. There has been concern that there aren't enough testing sites in underserved communities across town. Although the Curry administration is trying to rectify that, they're saying, do we have enough testing sites and are we doing enough testing? What are your thoughts?
I don't know the exact number of testing sites that we have, but we certainly would love to do more, right? I mean, there's no question part of the way that you get your handle on the disease is understanding, you know, who has it, where were they, you know, who were they in contact with. So part of that is being able to test. So we have plenty of testing capability at the hospital. So we test a lot of our emergency department patients. We test anybody who's having a procedure done, certainly as an elective basis. I know many of the hospitals are doing something very similar. But yes, it would always be nice to have more testing sites and more capability to do that. We actually made a decision very early in the equation, thanks to help from the governor's office, to do testing in underserved communities. And so we tried to stay away from cars and vehicles and really went into the community, into the neighborhoods. And that was led by our team, Ms. Amory Knight, who is our vice president of community engagement. And really the goal was to test underserved communities. We partnered with others on testing the homeless community. So there's no question that we probably need to do more tests.
Need to do more tests. Let me ask you as well. Last night, new city council president Tommy Hazzouri appeared on CNN, and he was asked a series of questions about the Republican National Convention coming here in August. That's a decision that has been highly controversial. A UNF poll shows a majority of residents in this community don't want the RNC here. They're worried it could spread coronavirus. You yourself were initially on the host committee for this event, but you've backed off that so that you can focus more on providing medical guidance to the city, as you said in a statement. Tommy Hazzouri said on CNN last night that if cases continue to rise and we continue to see this problem not being tamped down and the curve not being flattened, that the city council might have to make tough decisions, he said, about the RNC, that he would not allow people to go into the convention hall willy-nilly, in his words, with no masks or social distancing. In light of what we're seeing, and as a healthcare professional, do you think that the city made a mistake in agreeing to put this event on, and should they reconsider?
You know, it'd be hard for me to backtrack that, but let me tell you what we're focused on. We're focused on that the event may occur. I do agree that, you know, we're going to have to watch our volume every single day and make sure that we can get a hold on it, because really any event, right, any gathering, whether that's something as small as being in a bar, a football game, et cetera, a convention, whether it doesn't matter which party it is, all of those are certainly at risk. But we also have to worry from a hospital perspective that there are other things that can happen, right? If the event does in fact occur, you know, there may be 20 to 30,000 people here. So there's a COVID issue we have to evaluate, but there's also the potential for a terrorist attack. There's also potential for bombing. There's also potential for protests. So there are a number of things that the hospitals have to worry about, and that's kind of the role that we play. But yes, I think, you know, right now, I think everything is up in the air.
Right. It sounds as though you don't want to take a firm stance on your personal feelings about whether they should cancel the event. But what I'm hearing you say is that you're ready for anything and you're planning for a number of different scenarios. Tell us more about how you and the other hospitals are gaming all of this out and how you're planning for this event and the rest of the summer here with the pandemic continuing to afflict this city and this country.
Yeah, I mean, by the way, remember, we're still in hurricane season. So we have a team that, you know, plans out all of our emergency preparedness. And so we as hospital CEOs have a conversation at least a couple of times a week. We talk about, you know, do we have enough PPE? You know, what's our case volumes? How are we doing from a COVID standpoint? We sort of, in the role of the Level 1 Trauma Center, we're working closely with actually the Florida Hospital Association and some of their details around medical corps and making sure that we have enough physicians to support that. For us, it's what are the potential scenarios that could occur. For example, if there is an explosion, you know, what happens and how do we, you know, have the right equipment in place? How do we have the right people in place? Those kind of things. For example, if there are burns that are involved, you know, how do we get people to Gainesville? Because that's actually the burn center. So those are some of those distinct decisions that we make. What about our people? You know, who needs to be in the building? Who doesn't need to be in the building? You know, after hours, for example, you know, and, you know, what about the staffing from the perspective of making sure people can get here if streets are closed. So those are some of the details that we have to take into account. And by the way, there is the potential for a hurricane. And so, you know, we want to make sure that we're ready for that as well, which implies a little bit of different planning in terms of, you know, equipment.
Yeah, and you know, manpower. Just, I so, can't even imagine a major hurricane and a spiking corona caseload at the same time. But unfortunately, that's what you're having to plan for.
Yeah, absolutely.
It could be a real parade of horribles. Let's hope not. As we speak with Dr. Leon Haley, CEO of UF Health JAX, it's 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts about the new mask mandate for Jacksonville, how the city is managing the pandemic, the Republican convention coming here. In the meantime, let me get a few tweets on the air. Here's one for you, Dr. Haley. The mayor of Jacksonville Beach went on CNN this morning and said that in deciding to keep the beaches open for the 4th of July holiday, they consulted with medical experts and were told it would not have a significant impact on the spread of COVID-19. Does UF JAX Dean Haley, that's your Twitter handle, agree? So, the beaches this weekend, we're going to have open beaches in this community. South Florida has closed theirs for the 4th. We're not. Are you okay with that?
I think you can go to the beach, but again, if you keep the same rules in place, right, which is distancing, if you can manage that, I don't know how you manage sort of the flow of traffic to the beach. I mean, I think that's a different question. But I think being outdoors mitigates the risk. Obviously, distancing mitigates the risk. I think obviously not being in large gatherings mitigates the risk. So if you're going to the beach, you should go with maybe just your family or just yourself. I think you can do it. I think you can do it. I'm not sure I would go to the point of closing the beaches at this stage of the equation. Because I think you can do it safely. But I do think people, again, have to take into account masking, distancing, keeping apart, no large gatherings. I think those are critical to keeping them open.
We do know that it's safer outside in large groups than inside. We also are seeing a new study showing that the large outdoor protests on behalf of racial justice across America, including local protests, apparently had little effect on the pandemic. They didn't cause much of a spike in the cities where they happened. Can we attribute that to people being outside, most of the protesters being masked, or a combination of the two?
I'd say it's probably a combination of all of those things, right? So I think it's certainly being outside. I think there were a number of people that were wearing masks. And we do know also by the disease that there's a segment of people that even though they may be positive, don't spread it, right? So there's the concept of the super spreaders, right? So there are a number of people who might be positive but that never actually spread it. And then there's a small number of people that are positive that actually spread it to a number of people. So not inconceivable that, you know, we just didn't have enough super spreaders at whatever particular moment. So, and again, going back to, yes, people were wearing masks. Yes, they were largely outside. It does mitigate the risk, quite frankly. Inside is always a challenge.
Let me get this email on the air for you. We have gotten an enormous amount of feedback, by the way, digitally, for Leon Haley of UF Health. I can't believe everybody is blown town for the fourth already, though, and they can't call in. So call us up at 549-2937. Here's an email for you from Bill in Lakewood. I'm over 65, and I was surrounded this morning by a dozen tree service workers inside a gate gas station. They weren't wearing masks. When I called them out, they ignored me, and the manager says they can't require it. They said their policy is to post notices and require employees to wear masks, but that they cannot ask customers to do so. Gate was stubborn about this passive approach, and I was disappointed. Why would anyone concerned about public safety patronize a business that puts profits above lives, he says. So, Dr. Haley, companies are having to follow the mandate, although we're hearing different companies are handling this in different ways. What's your reaction to this kind of feedback we're getting?
You know, I think my reaction is I wish... It feels, at least for me, not that hard to wear a mask, and so not that hard to make that recommendation. And so I would hope that, you know, companies, individuals, you know, personal responsibility would, you know, follow the guideline, right? Which is, and by the way, that guideline has been in place for months. It's not a new thing, right? Since the beginning of the pandemic, we've talked about wearing masks, we've talked about being distanced, we've talked about avoiding sort of these large gatherings. So those things still remain. I remind people there is still not a vaccine at this point in time. And at best, we might get one by early next year. There's not a specific treatment. And I think what people fail to understand is, like I said, we have 40 people in the hospital. So our hospital volumes are higher than they've ever been. So people are still being hospitalized by this disease. People are dying at a rate less than they were earlier in the disease. But they're still dying. So I think people need to take this thing very seriously and just remember, that there are simple things that you can follow, and we hope that we'll try and enforce it as a community.
Susan writes on our Facebook page, face shields are now available. I like them better. What do you think of face shields as compared to cloth masks, she asks.
Cloth masks are still the best, right, because they particularly they prevent the spread better than a face shield does because, you know, it's not inconceivable. Yes, you could cough into this face shield that most of it will get got by the shield, but some of it will get around it. So ultimately, a mask is still the best thing. You know, if for whatever reason, medically, you can't wear one, then at a minimum, you need a face shield. Obviously, the other rules are still in place around distancing and large gatherings, but I would still recommend and choose a face mask over a shield.
Let's go to some calls now for Dr. Leon Haley, CEO of UF Health Jacksonville. Janice in Palatka. Hey, Janice. Happy almost Friday. Go ahead.
It's my Friday.
Yeah, me too, actually. What are your thoughts?
I wanted to commend Jacksonville for doing this mandate, being in the outer areas. We really appreciate them taking those steps because we'd like to see more of that. And I had a question for Dr. Haley. I do have a lot of concerns because I'm one of these high-risk people, and I can't get people that get within 2-3 feet of me to put a mask on. And I wanted to find out. I thought the only thing I could do is try to get a test to see if maybe I already had exposure and I'm asymptomatic. And if I want to get the kind of test that shows whether or not I have any antibodies, what test would I be looking for to take?
Yeah, thanks for that.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dr.
Good question. It's a serology test, so it's a blood test, right? The classic COVID test right now is a nasal swab. They are moving to develop some tests that can work off of just sort of saliva. But the serology test is a blood test. To be perfectly honest, I'm not sure we're offering them in the community. We do have them available at most of the hospital sites right now. But the serology test is a double-edged sword. So it can tell you whether or not you've had enough exposure to develop antibodies. The problem with it is it doesn't mean you won't get it. And by the way, you could be active with it. So actually for our hospital workers, if we do serology testing on them and they turn positive, then we actually go ahead and do a nasal swab right away because they could be active with the disease depending upon where you are in your serology testing. We know that sort of things like herd immunity don't seem to be showing up the same way that they do in some other diseases like measles and things like that. So it gives you some information, but it doesn't mean that you're not positive, by the way, even if you turn positive, and it doesn't mean you won't get it again.
Clear as mud, right? I realize how complex this is, but Janice, yeah. If you're still listening, I hope that helps you out. You know, Dr. Haley, I went and got an antibody test in May. My colleague, Michelle Corum, prompted me to do it, our Morning Edition host. She pointed out Avicenna Medical and others were offering them all through that month, 100% covered by insurance. So I went and got one, and it was negative. But as you pointed out, that doesn't necessarily mean it's not 100% reliable. So,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, people can certainly – the other thing about the serology testing is, let's say you get it on Monday, you can certainly get, infected by somebody on Monday afternoon, for example, or Tuesday. So it's only a point in time, as is, by the way, the nasal swab. So even when people turn positive, it's still a point in time. So if you get the nasal swab, for example, and it's negative, it doesn't mean you aren't currently positive. You just haven't generated enough antibodies to turn it positive, or you might get infected the next day. So
it's the lagging indicator. It's those lagging indicators that worry people so much. Yeah. And I'd like to get you as well to respond to, as we look at the numbers of COVID cases, getting data from hospitals in this community and in Florida has been difficult. Shouldn't hospitals be, and I'm not singling you out specifically, but shouldn't hospitals be more transparent at this time in letting us know exactly how many people are being treated and how many patients are active?
Well, we share our data with the state. We share our data with the city. The problem is if we share sort of just generic data, then it has the risk of being misinterpreted, right? So if I tell you, for example, that we've got 40 patients in the building, what does that actually communicate back to you? So I don't know. What we do share is how busy we are. The city knows, the state knows exactly what we're trying to manage. And we're very, transparent with people when people come and visit us. But we also don't share, for example, how many cardiac patients we have, how many trauma patients. So there's a little bit of personal privacy that we're trying to manage.
I understand that. But other states have opened the kimono more, given the unprecedented nature of this. And Florida has been roundly criticized for not doing that. Shouldn't we be able to get, as media outlets, getting this out to the public, more detailed data?
Again, we certainly could do that. We share the data. The state knows where the data is. The city has a good idea where the data is. I think if you put it out there without a lot of explanation, then it has the potential to be misinterpreted. So I think that's the risk. I understand every state has a little different take on it. The best part of it is, all of us as hospitals, we work very closely together. We work very closely with the city and the state and to try and manage the volume.
Lots of calls now for Leon Haley of UF Health Jax. Anna in Avondale. Hi, Anna.
Hi. I just have a little comment for Dr. Haley. I know how difficult it is to try to get people convinced, some people convinced, that wearing a mask is important, but it is important. However, I saw something today that the wisdom of the internet, that if you're inclined not to wear a mask and then you find yourself in the operating room, certainly you would want to tell your surgeon that he didn't have to wear a mask because it's uncomfortable and it gets hot and he can't breathe very well and it's not very effective anyway.
Yeah, Anna, you're absolutely right. I would never go in to be operated on by a surgical team that wasn't all masked and gloved up. So I think that tells you all you need to know, right?
Yeah, I've seen that on the internet as well. So, yeah.
Maureen in Nassau County. Hi, Maureen. How are things up your way?
Hi. We're actually spiking up this way.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a business owner up here, and we've had our employees wearing masks since we reopened in May. But we just recently put a sign on our door that said county commissioners are asking us to ask our clients to wear masks, or they're going to mandate it up here in Nassau County as well as Duval.
And you are in favor of that, I take it?
We are. We have had trouble asking people to social distance. They pull their chairs right up to our desks. They stand right next to us while they're talking. So wearing a mask would make me feel much safer.
Thanks, Maureen. You know, we've pounded this information out every day for months, but it can't be said enough. We are not out of the woods. Keep wearing your masks. Keep social distancing. Avoid large gatherings, people, as we speak with... Go ahead, Dr. Haley.
Well, I was just going to say, not only are we not out of the woods, we're deeper in the woods
now,
right? I mean, that's the challenge, I think, and sort of the reminder for everybody in the community. You know, we talked early in this, if you remember, about, well, if we beat this down, then we still have to be worried about a second wave. Well, I can tell you, we're still deep into this first wave, maybe even deeper than we've ever been. So it's a reminder, people, and this is, even if we get our hands around this, right, yes, there's potentially a second wave, but we may never come out of this first wave. So in order for us to really, you know, get out of the woods, to use your analogy, we absolutely have to sort of follow these guidelines.
And that brings me to a tweet from another listener for you. He wants to get you on the record about what I asked you about earlier. Please ask Dr. Haley, if he were mayor, given a binary choice between the RNC or no RNC, what would he choose? Doesn't having the RNC coming here make your job a lot more difficult?
I think any large gathering will make my job difficult, right? I think right now, given everything we know about COVID and where we are at this exact moment, I think any gathering, whether it's inside, outside, whether it's a convention, regardless of the political party, makes our job difficult. And right now is a big, big challenge, no question.
Do you agree with the doctors that sent a letter to Mayor Curry and his administration asking that the RNC be downscaled or changed or even canceled?
I think that there's great merit in what those doctors say. So yes, to many degrees, I agree with, we need to look at the convention, make sure if we're going to have it, and it's still a big if, I think, at this stage of the equation, right? Are there additional measures that we can take to make sure that, you know, if it's going to happen, we're as safe as possible?
You think there's a decent chance they'll change course, cancel it?
I don't know that. But what I'm saying is right now we're not winning the war against COVID, right? So our case volumes are continuing to go up. Our hospitalizations are going up. So right now, thinking about anything 2 months from now at that level seems very tough to manage.
We've got a Linda at the beaches. She just recovered from COVID, she says. Hey, Linda, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm lucky. I'm 71, but that 30 miles a week of walking kind of saves the lungs.
This
was my concern. Because I live at the beaches and I do occasionally go out to a restaurant, I've been taking my temperature all along because I felt like that was the only way I was quickly going to know I had it. But the problem is, when I hit 100 degrees, which was the third day in, I started trying to get a test. I couldn't get a test for a solid week. And there was no way in the world with a 100-degree fever I was going to sit in line at TIAA Bank. I will say, though, Quest drive-through at the beaches at Walmart, it was so professional. It was so awesome. It just, you do it yourself. They are so patient and wonderful. But you should be able to get it sooner so you know what you got, and you can deal with that rather than giving it to someone else.
Sure.
This just needs to be increased so quickly.
Thank you,
and
Linda.
Go ahead. The other comment, the only thing I wanted to say is living at the beach and for 20 years going to the beach for 4th of July, I fully agree the beaches should be open during the day. Families should be able to enjoy that 4th of July experience. But there is no way at night that it will be socially distanced in any way, shape, or form. Thousands will be on the beach with thousands of fireworks. and it is not going to be healthy or safe.
Thanks, Linda, and I'm glad you're doing all right. Okay,
oh,
Doc.
Great.
Yeah, I'm glad you're getting better. Dr. Haley, more testing and more contact tracing. They simply need to be done. And we see local officials here doing everything they can to get more testing sites up, but there has been no federal comprehensive uniform approach to tamping out this pandemic that other countries have undertaken. Widespread testing and contact tracing. We just haven't seen it in the United States in, at the level that we need.
That's correct. I mean, I think, yes, we have definitely fallen behind other sort of countries across the globe. And yes, we should be testing more. We should be tracing and understanding who people have come in contact with and where they've been. You know, obviously, as we've talked already, you know, masking and all those things, distancing, those are things that, you know, those are things that we own and control, and we've got to continue to try and do them.
Now, with all of this said, you at UF Health Jacks are going to be conducting, along with other healthcare officials in North Florida, COVID-19 community briefing today, actually, at 10 o'clock, that people can join virtually. Can you tell us about this briefing?
Yeah, actually, it's much of what we've already talked about. I'll give a focus on some of the things that we've worked on up in leading, you know, in the early phases of the pandemic, kind of where we are currently, the sort of perfect storm of what might happen over the course of the rest of the summer, and then maybe a few points on coming out of it, if, you know, if we can even look that far in the future, what are some of the things that we as an organization are going to work on?
So people can log on to this on Zoom, I believe, or
no, it's a phone call, I believe. It's not a Zoom. It's not virtual, actually.
So okay, so this is a conference call. You'll also be talking about the 150th anniversary of your healthcare system, too, right?
That's correct, yeah. So in the middle of a pandemic on June 4th, we celebrated the 150th anniversary of the hospital.
And if you want to give a quick plug to the importance of UF Health in Jacksonville, let's talk about that before we let you go. You are the region's public hospital, and you work closely with all of the other hospitals in this community, but you serve a special role in this city.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we are, in addition to being a public, you know, public hospital, we are really a very large academic health science center, right? So we are a leading site for training of residents, so healthcare professionals. We have a College of Medicine here, College of Nursing, College of Pharmacy. We do $30 million of research to try and advance our knowledge and discovery of diseases. And so we play a very significant role in the academic side of medicine in terms of health education and research, in addition to the major clinical roles of being a level one trauma center, a certified stroke center, place for cardiac disease, a number of other things, site of the proton center, one of the region's top, one of the country's top proton centers that serves, you know, more international patients, more children than any proton center in the world. And so, you know, we're very proud of our heritage. We're very proud of our 150th anniversary, and we look forward to serving the community for another 150 years.
Absolutely, and have a safe and happy 4th of July. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Dr. Haley.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Leon Haley, he is the CEO of UF Health Jacksonville with us just now. And much more still ahead later. It's a new campaign to protect sea turtles nesting right now at the beach. We'll tell you about it. And up next.
What if the fate of America came down to a dream team as diverse as the country itself?
A fictional tale that rings true to life today. We'll speak with author Andy Stack on his novel, The Black Hand, after this.
WJCT thanks the following business partners for their generous support. Vistar Credit Union, Jenkins Quality Barbecue, Constangi Brooks Smith & Profit, LLP.
Hanania Subaru of Orange Park would like to present our new dealership. 13 acres of new Subarus and a 34,000 square foot showroom with customer amenities. We're now at 6400 Blanding Boulevard or online at SubaruOfOrangePark.com.
Electro Lounge can now be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WJCT 89.9 HD4 Electro Lounge Radio or on the WJCT app. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Welcome back. Well, after the apparent murder of seven NBA All-Stars on a return flight from the 2020 Summer Olympics, a small clandestine team as diverse as America must save the country from itself. This is the plot. On August 9th, 2020, the world is celebrating the close of the Olympics in Tokyo, that date chosen to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki. But a domestic terrorism group calling itself the Chernaruka, that's Bosnian for the Black Hand, chooses the date of August 9th to attack America to commemorate another date in history, the 6th anniversary of the Ferguson, Missouri riots. So that's the premise for the new novel, The Black Hand, from St. Augustine author Andy Stack. He was partially inspired to write this after a visit to the former Yugoslavia and disturbing parallels he sees between that country's descent into genocide and where we are in America today. It's a fictional story, but it reads a little bit like our real life. I spoke with Andy Stack. Take a listen. Andy Stack, good to talk to you.
Thank you, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about The Black Hand. If you could describe the plot in one sentence, what would you say?
Yeah, I always say the book hook is, what if the fate of America came down to a dream team as diverse as the country itself? And if I tell that to someone, they're intrigued, and they go, okay, go on. Yeah, it's a dream team of regular Americans who band together and really save the country from a series of terrible attacks that were scheduled and some succeed on American soil.
And this is fiction, but you have a knack for sort of predicting things that have actually come to pass. So tell us a little bit more about some of the scenarios that you've written about and that you're writing about in this book.
Well, I want to be careful about using the word predicting. I just, again, I wrote this book or started writing this book almost a full year ago. And it was based on a number of personal experiences about divisiveness, about a country's divisiveness. And it really started on a trip, Melissa, I went to last year to the former Yugoslav Republic and had a chance to understand how that country literally disintegrated overnight. Based on mostly political and religious lines, but saw some similarities as to, you know, what we see going on in America today. And it frightened me. But in the story of the Black Hand, and there's an actual reference to what the Black Hand means in that region of the world, there's an organization that wants to leverage what they see as divisiveness in America for their own, you know, sort of personal and financial gain. And they do so by forming this terrorist group, domestic terrorist group, and leading a series of attacks against American cities.
Which isn't too far off from what we could realistically expect in real life in our current time. And so you've really hit on that anxiety that I think so many Americans have. And when you talk about a country like the former Yugoslavia, which, you know, descended into genocide and one sect murdering another sect, you know, that is the deep worry that Americans have, that our political divisions, our cultural divisions could lead to violence. Is that what drove your authorship of this book, that sort of free-floating worry?
It did, and there was actually some real-time references to why that worry was relevant to this book. And one is, and many people don't know this, but the city of St. Louis, Missouri, which is where the primary setting of this book is home to the largest Bosnian population outside of Bosnia itself. There's about 80,000 people of Bosnian descent that live in St. Louis, and they came to America as St. Louis was designated a sanctuary city. From that war, from the Balkan Wars of the early and mid-90s. And they play an important part in what now is the Black Hand story in the book that I wrote.
And tell us a little bit more about the story itself.
Okay, well, let me first explain a little bit about the name, because I think that's important in understanding the story. The name The Black Hand is just the English translation of a similar named group in the former Yugoslavia called the Chernaruka. And a Chernaruka means literally the Black Hand. And if you're familiar with your World War I history, that Sharon Arukha was responsible for the planned and successful assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo in 1914. Mm. That one event led to World War I and one of the deadliest events in world history. Well, that Black Hand now resurfaces in 2020. The book is set in the very near future, August of 2020. But that organization resurrects itself, but now in America, to cause, you know, national and international chaos by their criminal activities. It's a team of Americans that really were brought together by fate of two families that live in St. Louis, Missouri. The main protagonist actually was born and raised in St. Augustine, but was a 30-year veteran of the United States Army. And he now lives in St. Louis. Him and his best friend form this team of, if you want to call them counter-terrorists, but they have no experience in it. And they defeat this this new domestic terrorism organization that raises its ugly head.
So there are such striking parallels in this novel to what we're experiencing in America today. Race relations, political divisions, domestic terrorism, the fear of foreign interference in driving our divisions, particularly by Russia.
Right.
When you started writing this, did you have all of that in your head, that you were telling a fictional story that really isn't quite so fictional in some respects?
Well, and that's very well put. I mean, I've had a large team of advanced readers finish the book, and they're like, this is definitely a story of fiction, but it's not. The historical references, the social and political environment are so accurate, Andy, that people are going to learn a lot by reading this book, and I hope that's the case. But at the end of the day, I just wanted to make it a story that people enjoy, and when I say enjoy, they consume, you know, quickly and read the book, but maybe take a little bit of lesson away from it that, it's our diversity that makes us stronger, not weaker. And if we allow those forces outside, and you use Russia as a great example, to leverage our current divisiveness, we may have bigger problems in this country than we realize.
And the book is out now. Given COVID, you can't be doing in-person book signings so much, but people can still get copies of The Black Hand, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're available in all the major online retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I will be doing an in-person signing on July 25th, all things hopefully going ahead at the San Marco bookstore in downtown, in Jacksonville there, just across from downtown.
Oh, that's
good.
But
the best place to get the book is at my author's website, and that's andrewstackauthor.com.
Andy Stack, good to talk to you. His new novel is The Black Hand. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
And in a moment, the campaign at the beaches to save sea turtles this nesting season. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, our guest will be Patrick Stewart. This year, he returned to the role he's most famous for, Jean-Luc Picard, in the series Star Trek Picard. He played Picard in several Star Trek films and seven seasons of The Next Generation. Before that, he was a member of the Royal Shakespeare Company. I hope you'll join us. Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
In March, at the height of Italy's COVID-19 outbreak, the country reported 6,500 new cases per day. In April, Spain reported 10,000 new cases a day. Now it's July in the U.S.
I would not be surprised if we go up to 100,000 a day if this does not turn around.
Top epidemiologist Anthony Fauci puts America's response in a global context. Next time on The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Thousands of immigrants across the country are taking their final step to citizenship during the pandemic, not in large auditoriums or courtrooms, but from the safety of their cars.
This makes it a lot more personal almost. It's really fun being able to talk to people as they're driving through and get to hear a little bit of their stories.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Naturalization drive-thrus this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT.
30 years ago, just months after the fall of the Berlin Wall, President H.W. Bush pushed to make America more accessible.
Let the shameful wall of exclusion finally come tumbling down.
What difference has the Americans with Disabilities Act had on the country and the lives of those it claimed to champion? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, sea turtle nesting season is in full swing right now. And there's a campaign at the beaches to help as many of those little guys as possible succeed, you know, make it from their nest to the ocean. This campaign is called Clean Dark Flat, and that's a hashtag you can use and share on social media to help this threatened species. Kevin Brown is a volunteer with the Beaches Sea Turtle Patrol, and he's on the line. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, good morning. How are y'all?
I'm great, thanks. Good to be with you. So this is a campaign that involves your organization, Beaches Energy, and the city of Jack's Beach. Clean Dark Flat is what it's called. What does that mean, Clean Dark Flat?
Well, clean means, you know, less trash, less plastic, anything that the turtle could, in this case, consume or get caught into, like a plastic bag. Dark means low lights. We're not saying no lights, but we like lights out, like in front of the nest or during a emergence by the hatchlings or the nesting mother. And then flat is just keeping the shoreline its natural condition. Obviously, holes that are dug and used for recreation and entertainment, we would always encourage people to fill in their holes because they can trap a nesting mom or hatchlings emerging and getting back to the shoreline.
So keep the beaches clean, dark, and flat so that the sea turtle hatchlings can make it to the ocean. We are the largest nesting area in the world for the Northwest Atlantic loggerhead. Those are the kinds of turtles you are seeing nesting right now at the beaches. I'll never forget once going out to the beach to see the little hatchlings be released and racing to the ocean. And our kids will never forget it either. It's really magical. Can you explain how that process works and why it's so important to protect it?
Yeah, first of all, our organization, the Beaches Sea Turtle Patrol, we do, we monitor, we evaluate, and we maintain the turtle nesting process. So the mom will come up between May 1st and October 31st. That's how long the season is. She will nest, obviously, along our shorelines. And each species has an incubation, call it a gestation or incubation period, where the eggs go through their process. So we monitor it at that time. When I say maintain it, we try to keep foot traffic away from it, and we mark it so people will realize that is a protected marine species.
Mm-hmm.
Once the emergence occurs, we obviously are not there 24/7, so we encourage everybody that if you happen to see this event get very far away, you know, obviously it's one of nature's gifts. You can watch it, but we would love for you to call us and, or, you know, just stay back. Let those turtles do their thing and get to the water.
Right.
Once that occurs, we are permitted under FWC. We collect a lot of data for FWC, which then goes into a statewide database. We are an index beach, so we collect all kind of data, how far the nest is from the high tide line, the dune line, how long did it take to emerge. And once that emergence occurs, we are once again permitted to go in and we evaluate how many eggs hatched. And then we give all that data to FWC.
That's Fish and Wildlife. Yeah. I hate to cut you off. We're almost out of time. And I want to mention that people can support the Clean Dark Flat campaign at coffee shops across the beaches.
Correct.
Where they're doing a limited edition Clean Dark Flat coffee mug. If you buy one, you can support Beaches Sea Turtle Patrol just for $10. It's a collectible mug. That sounds like a kind of special coffee anyway, Clean Dark Flat. And you can, you'll see the signage from Clean Dark Flat at the beach access points. Beaches Energy is going to unlight some street lamps in accordance with the dark imperative. And so look for this hashtag Clean Dark Flat. Support it at your beaches coffee shops. Be mindful of the sea turtles nesting at the beach. Keep the beaches flat, dark, and clean, free of trash and other debris. So you can support this amazing effort and support your organization, Kevin, which is so valuable, the Beaches Sea Turtle Patrol. And I want to thank you so much. Is there anything else people need to know?
No, we just ask that, you keep it, like we said, clean, dark, and flat. Be very weary of the sea turtle season. And if you see anything that's unpeculiar or not in order, please give us a call and we'll have one of our volunteers there as quick as possible.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for all you do and enjoy spying those sea turtle babies. All right.
Yes, thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much. And if you do go out to the beach this 4th of July, be smart, be safe. Wear a mask. Don't get into big crowds if you can avoid it. That is our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our station news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. And I'm Melissa Ross. We will be off tomorrow, but back Monday. Have a safe and happy 4th of July weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.